She's a black belt in karate. Working for the city. She has to discipline her body. 'Cause she knows that it's demanding to defeat the
Good afternoon. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today, so happy to have Leslie Jamison here in studio. Leslie, thanks for returning.
I am so thrilled to be back. It's been a decade since I was here. We were just talking about the fact that perhaps Ann Arbor might be one of my Stonehenge places, and if so, I'll be returning every 10 years to talk to you in this beautiful station studio. I love it. I'm so thrilled to be back.
Oh, thanks. And thanks also for seeing the beauty that we see about WCBN.
Oh my God. I love a collage or a palimpsest in any form. So just station walls covered with stickers and names and history and love and like late night memories and the ghosts of late night snacks. Like I'm in love. I'm in love.
Well,
I'm not leaving.
And so don't wait 10 years. We don't have to make it like every decade kind of a thing. And because it's not like that for the books that are coming out into the world either.
It's true. So, I'm in a little bit of a faster clip. I often spend a long time working on a book, but then sometimes there's some overlap. Like I might be in one stage of the life cycle with one book, like those early kind of rough, restless stages, and then a little bit further along with another one. So, yeah.
Oh, so you're able to kind of manage that, like be in both of those worlds, each world of the book at...
Yeah, not like on the scale of a day, like I wouldn't be working on multiple, but like maybe I'll write multiple drafts of a book and I need between drafts, I need to be away from it for a little while. Like I need to give it to somebody else to read. I just need some space. And so maybe the way I give myself that space is by getting into the world of another book. And then there's like a pleasure in returning. I think there's a pleasure in returning to a home. There's a pleasure in returning to a radio studio. There's a pleasure in returning to a manuscript where you're like, oh, I've had the opportunity to miss you, mm-hmm. and I have some new ideas about you. And like, here we are back again, you know?
Oh, I love that. Cause you kind of, sometimes people say, oh, well then you can see it with new eyes too. Cause you have that little bit of distance, but I love the idea of adding, I've missed you.
Yeah.
It's like, so then there's like a sense of renewed connection or urgency about what might be happening in that world of that book.
Yeah. And maybe draft. A little more erotic charge. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yay. See, that's what we need on a Wednesday.
Yeah, here. Totally.
That's what we need. Keep us all going. Leslie, thanks also for picking today's songs for the intro and the breaks. Why the Flaming Lips? What was why did you choose? Oh, wait. Before you answer that, Splinters is the book that we have on the table with us today. Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. And so we're going to be talking about it today.
Yeah.
But I did want to mention that before we talk about The Flaming Lips.
Well, and you know, and it's, the two things are very connected because all of the songs that I chose for the program today are songs that felt part of the life era that this book is about, and particularly the life era of writing it. So the book Splinters is about really a 2-year period in my life that was just especially thick and electrical with experience. The first couple years of my daughter's life, which were also the years where my marriage ended. So it was very much a time of like life unraveling, but also life unfolding in these beautiful ways. And for me, the core of the book was absolutely not about these things happened to me, so I need to write about them. It was really about that experience of radical simultaneity, like how life can feel kind of unbearable or failed or degraded or shameful or dark or deoxygenated and also at the very same time kind of miraculous and brimming and bristling with meaning. And it was that bothness, that sense of both at the same time that I wanted to try to find a way of expressing. And the book kind of closes with me and my daughter alone in this two-person quarantine at the beginning of the pandemic. And a lot of the songs for the show are from a playlist that my daughter and I listened to together during that time. And so they bring me back to this time, of incredible sort of terror and loneliness, and also just the deep sweetness of communion, and for me the deep sweetness of like needing so much from art, like needing so much from music, needing so much from other people's voices, needing so much from like my daughter's kind of astounding play and getting to witness her, you know, feeling that in that state of intense need, I was also receptive to the world in a way that, like, in times when I'm just like going about my business and feeling fine, like my nerves aren't drinking it all up in the same way, you know?
Yeah, because often like we're pushed along by an exterior schedule, whether it's for work or, because I would count that as different than how you've described the time and the demands of the baby, of your daughter.
Right, right, right. Yeah. There's a very, I mean, I think there was a way that during the first year of my daughter's life, I was kind of compulsively trying to be in motion with my daughter. And there was a lot there. Like, there was definitely a feeling of like, I've brought this strange, incredible creature into the world, and I want to show her everything, like everything that I've built, everything I'm a part of, every community I'm in, every journey I go on. Like, I want her to be there too. So that was like the good part of it. And then there was also a part of it that was like, I was becoming aware that I wasn't living a life that I could stay inside of, that I was not happy in my home. It was, you know, that there was just a lot that was broken and not working. And so the ways in which my daughter and I were in motion, kind of out in the world and seeking out experience, there was also a way that even as I was like hungry for things, I was also running away from other things, another kind of both things true at once, you know. And but absolutely there was a kind of almost frenetic sense of going places with my daughter. And the book really tries to document that as well. Like that sense of just like, here we are. And like, I want to see everything with you. And then it closes in a space of like, here we are in this apartment. And how can we find the sort of different order of infinitude that exists in a very small Brooklyn apartment in the middle of a quarantine?
Yes. And the movement that you describe, it seems like at first, your daughter is the one that necessitates it in a way, because it's the only way she'll also sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So this constant movement, walking, or the Saskatchewan sway or so. is that right? Did I get it right?
The Saskatchewan shuffle.
Shuffle.
Yeah. Which is, so my maternal grandmother grew up on a farm in the middle of rural Saskatchewan, and so she had a name for this thing that, you know, many parents do and many parents have different names for, which is just like a baby is a little bit upset or a little cranky or just needs some soothing. And so you kind of shift, you hold the baby and shift your weight from side to side. And, you know, you can see parents doing it when another baby's crying, their body just kind of goes back into that muscle memory. It's really beautiful. But Splinters, among other things, is like an ode to my own mother and an ode to the matrilineal inheritance that I feel very much a part of. So like my grandmother, my mother, my aunt, my cousin, like I just come from this family of women whose like strength and innovation and warmth and care. I just feel like I've been able to kind of like absorb through my pores for my entire life. And so I think part of the urge to include that phrase, the Saskatchewan Shuffle, was a way of saying like, this book is about the forms of care that I've learned from the women in my family and the ways we've like named that care and the kind of language of care that this little ecosystem that I've gotten to be a part of.
And it's so clear, Leslie, from the very like opening pages of Splinters, when we're brought to the scene, when you, well, actually when you return from the hospital, it's most intense because you feel like you've been waiting for your mother to arrive. So, and you can see how, but maybe the ode to the mother begins because the mother's present before her physical presence is in the actual scene too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the book, so Splinters really begins in this moment of crisis. Like the book opens with me and my daughter showing up in this railroad apartment in Brooklyn in the dead of winter. A friend called it our birth canal because it was this, you know, it was this kind of dark, long unit. And we really arrived, like I arrived with our stuff in garbage bags. I mean, we had just left my home and there was a very urgent, very uncertain feeling about it. And so the book begins in that moment of crisis. Like, here I am. I have no idea. You know, I've left, in a way, I've kind of left my life behind and I have no idea what's next. And in that, in the kind of like radial field of that opening crisis, I think the book is really interested in like, when it feels like things are really breaking apart or falling apart, like where does sustenance come from? And what is the particular feeling of sweetness in that sustenance? So like, you know, the book's called Another Kind of Love Story for a lot of reasons, but certainly one of those reasons is that it's interested in the kinds of love that aren't necessarily the stories we hear told most frequently, the first kinds of love we think about. It's interested in the love between friends. It's interested in like the primal love story of like a woman learning to mother by watching her mother be everything she's been and love in all the ways she's loved, and sort of almost a process of looking back on my own history to excavate all the love I'd received in order to figure out how to pass that love along. But that idea of like, here we are in crisis, here we are in the birth canal, here we are in the dead of winter, and like, where does solace come from? And, you know, it ends up coming from a lot of places. It comes from New York City. This book is also kind of like a love song to the city where I live and the borough where I live. And it's a love song to my students and it's a love song to my friends. And it's, you know, more than anything, a love song to my daughter. But that idea of kind of like where, you know, in that dark opening, like what are all the little kind of cracks and fissures, bits of light coming in?
Within the dark opening of like this image where you bring us to like the apartment, is that what you mean?
Yes,
and then
it is, yeah.
And finding, yes, and then the story that is unfolding are these moments that we see that carry both light and dark, the bothness again,
yeah,
as
yeah,
you move
yeah, yeah.
forward through
yeah,
time,
yeah, yeah,
while also always managing to weave back in your foundation stories, like whether a lot, like you've mentioned with your mother. And the matrilineal heritage, but also with your father and his absence, and also dinners later on with the family as we get through like further along in the arc of the
yeah.
book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think one of the questions of the book is like when we parent or when we care for other people, like where is that care coming from? Like, what is the kind of deep, complicated reservoir in a self that care comes from? And that reservoir is shaped by all the ways we've been cared for by our parents and our families and our lovers and our friends. And it's also, that reservoir is also shaped by all the times and moments where we craved care or love and were somehow betrayed or disappointed. And the title of the book, Splinters, is, you know, it means a few different things. It's certainly thinking about kind of emotionally charged experiences that get lodged inside of us, often painfully, and we can't get rid of them. Like, they're part of us now, like the splinters that sort of stay in us. But it's also very much about the form of the book. So the book is written in these short, sharp shards of prose, and that form felt right for this book for so many reasons, but one of them is exactly what you're saying. Like, it allowed me to move back and forth in time with a kind of freedom so that I could follow emotional logics and associative logics. And I mean, don't get me wrong, the book is mostly chronological. Like, it's mostly telling the story of a marriage and a marriage coming apart and like beginning to raise a little girl. But within that trajectory, you know, it's moving around in time and through memory as it needs to kind of explain where some of those compulsions, aversions, fears, desires that the self of this narrator is expressing, where do they come from? That great mystery of like what makes a self how it is.
And was it part of the, as you were drafting the manuscript, is that how it was also coming to you, like, or coming out of you in like the day-to-day of the writing of it, Leslie? Was it something where there'd be these like sharper scenes and then you'd have a chance to think more and then you'd write part of that? Or is it something that you wove in later, or a mixture?
Yeah, maybe? I mean, the prose was definitely coming out in this unit size. Like, my one of my best friends, Colleen, who's also a writer, and I like to talk about finding the unit size of a book, like what are the bricks that it's built of, and how big are they, and how frequently do you move between them? How frequently do you find yourself in the pause of a white space? Like, and with this book, really early, it became clear to me that the unit size was pretty small, that it was like a paragraph, maybe max 5 or 6 paragraphs, like not generally longer than a page. And there was something about that rhythm that just felt so right to me. And I think it had to do with a few different things. It had to do with wanting the book to have a very kind of a sharp but also really tender feeling to it. Like, I wanted every moment of this book to feel super saturated with kind of visceral intensity and emotional intensity. And to that end, I kind of wanted each fragment in the book to have the feeling of a whittled blade. Mm-hmm. But I also felt that the two core narratives that I knew would be part of the book, the narrative of my marriage ending and the narrative of raising a very young child, were both kind of well suited to these sort of fragment units for different reasons. Like, I think taking care of a young child is full of repetition, banality, tedium. Nobody wants the comprehensive play-by-play, I think. I certainly didn't want to offer it, but I did want to offer just like these kind of glowing moments that seemed to hold some of the truth of it. And with my marriage, I knew that there were lots of parts of the story that I wasn't going to tell for personal reasons, but also artistic reasons. And so I wanted to have a form that could allow me to dive in to kind of big, messy experience and pull out exactly the kind of gleaming fragment that I needed, and no more, no less.
Mm. Leslie, let's take a short break. And then when we come back, we'll hear more about Splinters, another kind of love story, out with Little Brown. Leslie Jamison is here today in the studio. We've got Jason behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
In the rear view mirror, hasn't caught a thing yet.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Leslie Jamison is here, her book on the table with us, her latest, Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. Leslie, thanks again for being here and choosing the songs. What about the song?
First of all, so great to be back. So Souvenir by Boy Genius is a song that, I mean, it moved me the very first time I heard it, but I associate it particularly with a bus ride that I used to do once a week, basically coming back from my ex-husband's apartment on Sunday afternoons after dropping my daughter off with him. And, you know, we had, you know, but part of what Splinters is about, a big part of what Splinters is about is kind of forging a life that was, you know, a new home for me and my daughter, but that also was punctuated by the two nights a week that she spent with her dad, which were, like so many things in the book, kind of painful, and they were full of a lot of different feelings at once. So there was a feeling absolutely of pain. We separated when she was very young, and I had never spent even a night apart from her. So there was a sense of real grief at realizing that she would spend part of her childhood, a significant part of her childhood, in a home that was not my home. And this book is in part about that grief. But it's also about the ways that those two nights a week without her became sites of a certain kind of freedom. You know, I was able to move through the world in ways that I couldn't when I was, you know, taking care of her in the ways that I was taking care of her about 85% of the time. So those bus rides, those Sunday afternoon bus rides, I was always feeling so much. I was like grieving the part of my life that was, you know, not going to be spent with my daughter. I was also feeling the freedom of that. And that song, Souvenir, felt like it just held a lot of different feeling at once. It held a certain kind of despair, and it also held such beauty. And it just felt like this, almost like this clay vessel that could give me a way to hold these radically conflicting things that I was, you know, feeling as I was kind of like gazing in my emo way out the bus window. So that's where this song takes me.
And would you ever literally have headphones with you and be listening? Or is it more like, because you also mentioned playing this music in the apartment in Brooklyn when the two of you, you and your daughter, during the, you know, the early days and mid days and latter days of the pandemic too.
Yeah, I would absolutely. I never like being on transport without some kind of song in my ears. So I would definitely have my little earbuds in, looking out the window, you know, dreaming my daydreams. I'm actually, maybe we'll get to this later, but one of the books that I'm working on right now is a long book length essay about daydreaming. And I have a lot to say about daydreaming, but I definitely associate like being on a bus or a subway or a train, sitting next to the window, got the earbuds in, songs playing, you know, that's just like, that's the soil that daydreaming needs to, or it's a conducive yes. soil to daydreaming.
And the movement. Yeah. Again, you have movement. Yeah. You're moving along with this, the dreaming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And thinking and yeah. wondering. Oh,
Do you often daydream in motion?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And thinking too. I think so, like just to be moving and, totally. And have that.
And to be kind of in, often when we're moving, it's like, it's an in-between moment. Like we're in between work and home. We're in between one relationship and another relationship, or one role and another role. And there's a way that those cracks, you know, can be quite fertile. We're a little bit like unhitched from ourselves or something.
Yes. Oh, I love that. I'm going to be thinking of that too a little bit more in my. I like that it's also unhitched, not necessarily unhinged from ourselves.
Right.
Because I'll
also have some of those moments.
Yeah, I'm no stranger to those either. Yeah.
But well, Leslie, I wanted to also ask you about you mentioned artistic reasons in the last quarter before our break. And there was a moment where I thought it was so interesting that you actually take the reader behind the curtain with you, like to show some of your own process for making the decisions. I thought which went into the writing of Splinters. Mm-hmm. And the one example that comes to mind is when you show us the scene when you're in the hospital, mm-hmm. and the first time they have to take your girl away because she's jaundiced, mm-hmm. and so they take her and it's upsetting, and they're going to bring her back, but they go to the lights that are down in another hallway, right? And you write the scene, and then we go forward with you through other scenes and the other splinters, right? But then there's a little further along, we get to a splinter where you say, because there's a reckoning more with like the duality of this wanting to be all the time with, and then also needing to feel like some kind of selfhood when you're reckoning with that.
Yeah.
And you say, I stopped the scene here.
Right.
I didn't tell you that I reached down to grab my laptop and do some emails.
Right, right.
And this is after you'd been weeping and you didn't know you were weeping. The nurse said, she's going to be okay. And then you're like, oh, right.
Yeah.
So was this like intentional then, where you were also trying to show the reader, like generously, I think, this is how this is being built. This is the movement of this in my mind.
Thank you so much for asking that question, asking it in that way. Everything you're saying is so attuned to what I had in mind when I was constructing that passage and also returning to it. I mean, as you say, the first time I write it, I sort of end in a kind of an archetypal moment, like a mother who's deeply worried about her child and kind of can't stand to be apart from her child. So I'm weeping as they like wheel my daughter away. And that was real. It happened. It was a strong feeling that I can viscerally remember to this day. But it's also true that once she was gone, I set this up earlier in the book, but I was trying to close a magazine piece about 3 weeks before her due date, and she came 3 weeks early. So it was like already this collision between my sort of like ambitious, grip fast, like, you know, kind of I'm going to get everything done self, and then, you know, the self who's becoming a mother and like, enjoy your plans on that piece of paper, because like your plans are about to get disrupted by life and a tiny creature and like birth doesn't go the way you imagined and she's here early and all that. So, you know, but there I was in my hospital room thinking, well, now that it's 2 a.m. and I have some time, let me, you know, reply to this fact checker. And so, you know, but I realized that the first time I wrote the scene, I still had shame about writing that I had picked up my laptop again, because it seemed to falsify the emotion that had come before. Like, well, was I really so connected to my daughter if it was so easy for me to just suddenly revert back into like right. career mom mode or whatever? And also like just feeling like there's something about the kind of grit and steel of that ambition that in my mind, despite everything, still like had no place in a, you know, on a postpartum ward or something like that. And so right. the reason that I didn't just want to write the scene straight through the first time was because I wanted to structurally dramatize my own resistance, my own shame, my own stuttering hesitance to tell the full story. I wanted to kind of bring a reader into that feeling of like, oh, what was it harder for me to share and why? And to give that sort of feeling of saying even the parts that are hardest to say.
And that's what it feels like makes something then takes it into the realm of memoir instead of this documentation, right? That's one of the freedoms. That's why you would work in memoir, right?
Well, and I think the structure of kind of how you tell a story and how you tell which pieces when is absolutely part of why, like, you know, personal narrative, personal essays, hybrid essays, memoir, all these forms are not, it's not simply saying what happened as if that's a passive or straightforward process. It's really a task of construction and self-construction and a infinite parade of artistic choices and, you know, being able to dramatize the stuttering, being able to dramatize sort of like keeping a secret from a reader and then disclosing that you've kept a secret. All of this is like tremendously exciting to me on a craft level. It feels like it creates the texture of honesty, and I don't mean texture of honesty like it's artifice or false in some way, but just like, yeah, honesty is not a lubricated and straightforward process. Like honesty is a difficult, ragged kind of two steps forward, one step back process. And how can the craft of this book kind of betray the raggedness of that process?
Thanks, Leslie Jamison. That is, I'm like, amen, sister. We're going to take a short break today on Living Writers. Leslie Jamison is here. Splinters, another kind of love story. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
I've been contemplating suicide, but it really doesn't suit my style, so I think I'll just act bored instead and contain the blood I would have shed. She makes me feel so ill at ease. My heart
Welcome back. If you're tuning in, you're just in time because today on the program, Leslie Jamison is here. Her book, Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story, out with Little Brown. Was that Courtney Barnett?
Yes, it was.
I love her. Sorry, go on.
No. I'm so glad to have this affinity. She's this song, Shivers, was brought into my life by one of the characters in this book, the tumbleweed, the musician that I fall in love with at a certain point, who is many things, but I can genuinely say I have nothing but warmth in my heart towards him. He's like a wonderful human being, and there's a scene in the book where we meet up in Houston, and I have so many memories of like cruising around Houston, listening to that particular song. So it definitely brings me back to like these kind of like long, humid, cigarette smoky nights, and
yeah. So evocative.
Yeah,
because you feel like it's already in her voice, and then you had all the senses as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, before, okay. See how easy I'm going to get chatting again. So I promise, Leslie, I'm going to do some of the regular parts, the conventions of Living Writers, right, everybody? So here's the bio in the back of Splinters. Leslie Jamison is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Recovering and The Empathy Exams. The collection of essays, Make It Scream, Make It Burn, a finalist for the Penn Diamondstein Spielvogel Award, and the novel, The Gin Closet, a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize. A regular contributor to The New Yorker, she teaches at Columbia University and lives in Brooklyn. And we're so lucky to have Leslie coming to town here with Splinters because of the Zelle Visiting Writers series. You're part of that. You're one of the writers here this semester. And tomorrow you'll be on stage at the Helmut Stern Auditorium at 5:30. So that's October 24th. It's Thursday, everyone. Heading to UMA at 5:30 p.m. downstairs to the Helmut Stern Auditorium. You'll find Leslie there. There's also a craft talk on Friday, which will be in Angel Hall in the Robert Hayden Room on the third floor.
So you could check that out too. But definitely swing by because you'll be reading from Splinters.
I will be. Yeah. I feel like I should be taking notes so I remember where I'm supposed to be when. But yes, I'll be reading from Splinters. And, you know, when you were reading my official bio, I was both feeling such kinship with you as somebody who always just gets swept up in the rhythms of conversations. Like, I feel like every time I go to a restaurant, I should wear a sign that's just like, don't even bother taking our order until we've been here for 45 minutes. But it's funny because looking my author photo for this book, which I realize listeners can't see, but I'm wearing this sort of geometric colored dress and I'm sitting on this like little pink piece of lawn furniture. And I love the author photo just feels like so expressive of the book itself because I'm wearing a dress that I bought early on in my separation about which I had many daydreams. Like I imagined all these future versions of my life or scenarios from possible future lives where I was like wearing this dress, you know? So the dress became a way that I was like trying to imagine what life might look like once I had kind of derailed from the life I thought I was living. And then this little pink chair is my daughter's chair. She found it on the street one day and made it stay up. So I just love that it's like I look sort of sophisticated, but then actually I'm just sitting on a piece of toddler furniture. And that's kind of like the book in a nutshell.
I love that. Thank you. I love that backstory too. And you look very like, you look fierce. Like you're not going to look away.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always a triumph. I'm such a smiler. I have like, I want to make you comfortable resting face or something like that. Like it's very hard for me not to smile in photographs. So I actually really love that this photograph, which was taken, it's like another way in which is emblematic of the book. The photo is taken by Grace Ann Ledbetter, who is a former student of mine, who also often babysits for my daughter and is an incredible photographer. And Grace Ann was able to coax me into so many different emotional states. And I feel like the emotional state of this photograph is like, there's something a little steelier about it. And this book also feels, I mean, this book, I hope the tone of this book is many things. The tone of my life was many things during the years this book is about. But my voice is a bit different in this book than I think it is in anything that I've written. It's a bit it's sharper. It has different edges to it. It can be quite tender, but it's also quite, there's a wryness to it and a bite to it that felt a little different to me too. I wrote more of this book straight onto a computer, a little bit less of it by hand. And I think that allowed me to find a different version of my own narrative voice in a way that was like really kind of interesting to explore. So I feel like my face in this author photo is also kind of like, who is this self inside of me that's not always kind of fumbling over her own feet in order to make everybody else feel comfortable, who's kind of saying sharp, clean things and then letting them stand.
And being there with them. Like, yeah. This is something that is also, there's this consciousness about working in the forms that you are also trailblazing, I think, is that you're working in it and not looking away for yourself, but also bringing others to see it too. That's.
Yeah. And I think
part of the creation.
And I love that you frame it that way, like kind of staying with things too, because I think this book is also trying to explore like what allows us to kind of stay in the room with our own experience, like what allows us to just stay with the fact that, you know, an experience might be really hard, or stay with the fact that our life isn't turning out how we thought it would. And what does it look like to actually turn off all of the parts of us that are trying to figure out how to turn away from that fact by like, well, maybe I can solve it. Maybe I can redeem it. Maybe I can make it better. And there's a moment where my therapist makes luminous cameo appearances in this book. And there often, I would say the role she plays is that I go there looking for her to say, it's all okay. And she doesn't always say it's all okay, but she says something even better. And one of those moments is a moment where I'm kind of worrying out loud to her about the impact of my divorce on my daughter. And some part of me that I don't think I'd even acknowledged myself wanted her to be like, oh, don't worry, like, there won't be an impact or something. It's like so crazy and implausible, but like we all have fantasies that, you know, the mother figure of a therapist might just say, no, 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 nothing to worry about. And she said, you know, you need to accept that there will be an impact on her, and you will sit right beside that impact responding to it. And I have this image of like two birds on a wire, like impact and response. And that to me is another version of staying with experience. Like there's an impact. And also, if you're willing to keep showing up, if you're willing to stick around, like you get to have a response to that impact.
Mm-hmm. And the staying with Leslie, I think and I do remember that scene with a therapist. Thank you for going to that. It also, listening to you, makes me think of the structure of the book and how, and you mentioned it earlier in the conversation, how we end with a movement of fever where you and your daughter are, it's the early days during the pandemic. And in that part, in that section, you talk about being the forced part of being there with the two of you, with yourself, with the thoughts, and being slowed down and the staying with.
Mm-hmm.
So in Splinters itself, that's where you bring us to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Scene wise.
Yeah. Yeah. The pandemic, I think, definitely gave people a lot of experiences of staying with experience rather than going anywhere, because we were with our homes and our families all the time. But you're absolutely right that I think that's part of why the book ends in that first month of pandemic quarantine, because as anybody who's written personal nonfiction knows, you don't end somewhere because it happened. You end somewhere because it serves some sort of artistic purpose for the story you're telling. And I think I wanted this book, you know, this book is structured in three acts. They're called Milk, Smoke, and Fever. And Milk is the first year of my daughter's life before my marriage ends. Smoke is the second year of her life when I'm sort of navigating separation, feeling my way into kind of new forms of possibility and freedom, but also living through a lot of grief. And then Fever is this third act about this, like the very intense kind of bonding of quarantine. And the movement that I felt across those was almost a dialectical movement, which sounds more theoretical than I mean it to be, because it's also very embodied. But like Milk is about this kind of intense connectivity with my daughter. Like the first year of her life, it felt almost like we were one body. And Milk is obviously also about nursing and kind of being one body in that way. And then Smoke is about kind of rebelling almost against that feeling of bondedness. And so, you know, I do some smoking in that book, and smoking is like my one, you know, I'm 14 years sober and it's like, what vices do I have left? I have basically sugar and the occasional cigarette. And so smoke is kind of a way of, yeah, there's like smoky nights in Houston, like the misguided love affair, like the kind of reckless humid nights in the city. And then Fever is like kind of coming back into this bond with my daughter, but trying to bring all of myself into that bond, trying to say, yeah, like this is the two of us in the world, but also myself is bigger than you, and yourself is bigger than me.
And you're also in you brought low in this, because you get sick early.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Milk, Smoke, and Fever are all very literal, and the fever was a literal COVID fever.
And with the circles, that's why I thought it was so interesting when you said we're back in Brooklyn. When you talked earlier, Leslie, about the arc of the book, how we start in sort of the birth canal apartment by the firehouse, and then in the last part in Fever, where we're in Brooklyn in another apartment.
Yeah, we're living in another apartment by the end of the book. The book actually ends with this ends in Maryland. We're visiting,
yes,
two friends.
That's,
yeah,
that's what I feel like, because I thought that was, I loved that choice. So when you were saying that, I thought, oh, I'm misremembering it. But I love that you're in Maryland and that you're outside and you're seeing like the images that you just described to us. You're actually also seeing these circles that are made with the asphalt,
mm-hmm,
and how they try to glue and mend it, the cracks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm happy, you know, I'm happy to read from that part of the book or another part of the book, too, just because we're right there, you know. Tell me.
Let's read. I think what we'll do is we'll let's
let's read through this short break, Leslie Jamison, okay? And then we'll have a few minutes, and then it'll be our time today.
Perfect. Okay. Well, I will just, you know what I love? I did a reading once in Chicago where they said, can you read the end of this book? And I had never read it. And I've never read aloud. I mean, I've read it aloud to myself, but I've never read the end. And I don't think it's like a spoil. This book isn't really a spoiler. So a spoiler kind of situation. On that trip, my daughter was still sorting everything into mama things and baby things. Mama carrot and baby carrot. Mama pasta and baby pasta. Mama grass and baby grass. The cul-de-sac at the end of our friend's country road was mama circle. The little patch of tar in the middle was baby circle. If you existed in this world, you were either a mama or a baby. You were taking care of someone or being taken care of. My daughter was both. She was practicing loving things. She loved her little plastic dinosaur by putting him in the kiddie pool. She loved her baby pancakes by putting them in her mouth. She knew the baby circle had once lived inside the mama circle, in a hospital waiting room, in a blue maternity shirt, on a freezing day. But she knew the mama circle was bigger than the baby, and the baby circle was bigger than the mama, too. Part of me felt flooded with sufficiency. Sunlight could fall on a patch of tar on a country road, and we could stand there and have everything we needed. It was enough. Another part of me knew it was okay to want more than just our clasped hands, to want twisted sheets in a Houston hotel room and quiet mornings at my laptop, tap, tap, tapping at my keyboard while grad students read Marxist theory at sidewalk tables below. It was okay to want cigarettes at the beach and bone broth underground. My daughter broke me open for the whole world. She broke me open for everything that wasn't her. On that sunlit asphalt, her tiny hand was in my hand until it wasn't, until it was pointing at something else instead. Tar ribbons in the road beneath our feet, radiating from the dark heart of the baby circle, gleaming like veins of oily black blood. Mama lines and baby lines. When I bent down to look closer, the waist of my shorts rubbed against my scar, that doorway between the world before her and the world she made. She wasn't going back inside me. My scar wasn't going anywhere. The sunlight wasn't going anywhere until it did. And even then, we'd have the night.
Thanks, Leslie. Thanks for reading the end.
Well, and I have to say, you know, the end, I mean, like I said, she wasn't going back inside of me is both a spoiler and not a spoiler at all. But on a craft level, you know, one thing that I was thinking about as I read this out loud is I'm remembering back to this crucial, beautiful, elegant, incredibly wise piece of feedback I got from one of my readers about an earlier draft. And the earlier draft ended, I believe, with the line, it was enough. Like this idea of like me and my daughter on the sunlit road, we've been through this pandemic, her hand in my hand, it was enough. And my friend, who's an incredible writer in her own right, who maybe you've talked to on the show, Melissa Phoebos, read a draft and she said the most incredible thing. She said, I just had a little bit of sand in my shoe about the ending. Like there was something that's
gentle.
Yeah. And very evocative. I knew exactly what she meant. Like something just, it's uncomfortable. I need to deal with this. Yes. You know, there's something there. And she explained a little bit more about what she meant, but I really knew what she meant, which was like that so much of what the book had been working towards was like, does motherhood have to involve this sentiment of like, this is me and my child in this pastoral scene of togetherness and clasped hands, like this is enough. And she was like, it feels like the book is actually trying to say it's okay to want more. And I was like, yeah, you're totally right. But still some ingrained script about motherhood had been holding my hand in that moment of the writing process and making me feel like what I should feel or what I should
That's
say.
That's where you should arrive.
Yeah. And so it was really kind of thrilling actually to say, yeah, some part of me felt this was enough, and also some part of me wanted more, and to kind of write into that messier truth lurking just behind the kind of polished final sentence that sounded right but wasn't actually quite holding everything.
And that, I mean, how long did it take you? Like, it almost feels like that part probably came out pretty easily, like going into that and to find it, and also trusting the images of the circles that you had and finding the black ribbon that is blood or...
Yeah, yeah.
Or an umbilical cord or so. Or
yeah, I think trusting the images is exactly right because in that way, I'm not a poet. Like, I don't have the skills of a poet, but I feel like some of my methods feel like the methods of a poet. Like, I trust the world and I trust visceral experience. And if you kind of pay attention, it kind of carries a lot. And I think here, even just these small details, the fact that my daughter had to stop holding my hand in order to point at other things, right? Like, I think there's a lot just even in that moment. Like, yeah, sometimes we have to let go of other people or kind of be alone for a moment in order to stay curious, in order to keep exploring, in order to keep noticing. And that it's one kind of closeness to hold somebody's hand, and it's another kind of closeness to say, hey, look at that thing over there. But it's a necessary form of closeness too.
Yeah, and an intellectual type of closeness or curiosity, whereas maybe the physical feels like more visibly emotional or at least tactile.
Yeah.
But the other is such a powerful connection.
Yeah.
Which is something your memoir is always, I feel like, within like the ideas as well as the physical practicality of a moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this book is very much both, and its splintered form actually allows me, I felt as I was writing it, permitted in this way that I really appreciated to move between rumination and staying close to the physicality of experience. But I really, my writing always believes in what my friend Lynn Steger-Strong, who's also a wonderful writer, talks about, just like staying close to the body and how much you learn when you stay close. And I was so grateful for that language because I think I've been trying to do that for my whole life as a writer. Kind of, if you stay close to the body, what do you notice? What do you see? I give my students sometimes, I teach a class at Columbia called Writing the Body, and the first assignment is called The Week of Paying Attention, and it's very simple. It's like, for 1 week, every day, write down two or three things that, two or three moments of bodily experience that you notice that stay with you. And students are inevitably writing about, like, getting caught in subway doors or, you know, but it's, the point is, if you pay attention to what happens to your body, everything is waiting there for you.
I love that. I feel like you've just, Leslie, given everyone like an action item they can do too, like for writing as well before. Yeah, because we have like a closing couple of minutes ahead of us. But that's really generous and inspiring. And do you have something, like, I wanted to get a quick word in, if we could, about what you're working on now, Daydreaming, because this writing feels like the edges and the roughness, the raggedness, the splinters. How is it for you now working with Daydreaming?
Yeah. So I'm working on a novel,
okay.
which is about it begins with the story of the Minotaur, and particularly the Minotaur's mother. So it's also very much about motherhood and maternal abandonment and kind of the darkness of being a mother. So that's a project that's been a secret for a long time, but it's not a secret. I'm open in the world with it. I'm writing a novel about the Minotaur's mother. Here I am. but I'm also working on this book-length essay about daydreams. It's very much, it feels in a way not quite like a return, but the mode is very much the mode of like my collection, The Empathy Exams, where it's drawing on personal experience. I confess a lot of my own daydreams, but it's also telling the story of like, who are the psychologists and scientists who have studied daydreams? Like, who are the great daydreamers of literature? Like, I definitely have a whole reckoning with Madame Bovary. I asked 150 people about their daydreams on this questionnaire, and so there's also a kind of chorus of the daydreams of strangers that's moving in and out of the text. So it has just been a delight, and it's not because it's I would say it's very interested in how we move between spaces of fantasy and like the ragged, rough textures of reality. Like what is the passage back and forth like, and what parts of the self are kind of created and abraded in that passage back and forth.
And sometimes blurred.
And sometimes blurred, yeah. And how are the lives that we live in our daydreams like a part of us, a really important part of us, rather than like the only thing that matters about us is like that the actual things we do, the actual lives we live. Like, you know, Adam Phillips, who I engage with quite a bit in the book, is a beautiful kind of philosopher of our unlived lives and how they are kind of splinter style lodged inside of us.
Leslie, thanks so much for talking today.
Thank you so much for having me. I could talk for hours and hours. I know we can't, but I'll be back someday.
Yes,
soon.
Yeah. Right? We'll talk soon.
We'll talk about daydreams.
And I would, yes. Oh my goodness. I can't wait. Today, Leslie Jameson, her book, Splinters, Another Kind of Love Story. Tomorrow, Thursday at UMA at 5:30, Leslie Jameson will be reading from Splinters and also maybe doing a Q&A after.
For sure.
And now in our present moment, I think we've got sports up next. Thanks to Jason for taking us out with a song. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Live from Ann Arbor, this is the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, joining you for the second day in a row. I'm joined by Joey, Andrew, and newcomer Seth. So, Seth, welcome to the show for the first time. Glad to have you on. Andrew, Joey, welcome back. How are we all doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I'm doing great today, Vihan. Thanks for asking.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, and so, you know, as always, we'll start with a little icebreaker type thing. We'll keep it simple. Name one good thing that happened to you today.
I found this like new artist that I've never really heard before, Chelsea Wolf. She kind of has like a alternative sound to her. I'm really enjoying her. Apparently she did soundtrack work for like the X movie, the horror movie with Mia Goth, and no, I'm really enjoying her album that, you know, I found. So
For me, I just got a good grade back on one of my midterms. So
nice,
glad
nice. Love to see it.
Glad to get that off
what
the,
class,
my chest.
What class was it?
Soc exam, so oh, you know, cool. Nothing too big, but yeah.
I just got some new clothes that arrived today, and so that was pretty exciting.
Nice, nice. And for me, I also got a good grade back on my midterm, which means I've actually started off midterm season pretty well. So academically, we're off to a good start. And unfortunately, another thing that I care a lot about is not off to a very good start, and that is the New York Knicks. And that's our segue into today's topic of discussion, which yesterday we kind of kept the NBA talk a little abbreviated, but today it's going to be nothing but NBA. We're going to give you a 30-minute tip-off preview right here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. So without further ado, why don't we just go around in the circle?